91 FM. Well, with me now is Robert Indiana, whose sculpture of the four letters that spell love has delighted Philadelphians and visitors to the city. It's located in the Kennedy Plaza. I think many Philadelphians regard the love sculpture as a good-natured reminder of what the world needs more of, but the meaning of Indiana's love may be altered if you place it in the context with some of his other work. Since the 1960s, he's been interested in signs, particularly traffic signs, and one of his paintings from 1964 is called USA 666. And this assemblage of highway road signs says USA 666, USA Eat, USA Die, USA Air, USA Hug. Indiana has been quoted as saying, "I find eat and die much more interesting than love." In his sign pieces, Indiana is working not only with the meaning communicated by the language, but also with more formal concerns of geometric shape and the interaction of bright, vibrant colors. In the early 60s, many critics grouped Indiana with the pop artists. He collaborated with Andy Warhol on the 1964 film Eat, and that same year, for his first public commission, he created a 20-foot-high Eat sign for the outside of the New York State Pavilion of the World's Fair. His first love painting was in 1966, and he's been commissioned by several countries to do love sculptures in their tongues. In 1973, he was commissioned by the U.S. government to design a special stamp for someone special, and he designed a love stamp, which was originally issued in Philadelphia. His work has been shown in museums around the world. He's been commissioned for sculptures in many places, and he's in Philadelphia to receive the Award of Excellence from the Friends of the Moore College of Art. Robert Indiana, by the way, lives in Maine now, and he's working on 8-foot-high sculptures of his number series. Robert Indiana, it's a great pleasure to meet you, and I want to welcome you to Fresh Air, and congratulations on the award that you'll be receiving tomorrow.
Always nice to be in Philadelphia, too.
Before we get to your art, let's start with your name.
Mm-hmm, sure.
You weren't born with a name, Robert Indiana.
No, I simply was born in Indiana, and I lived there for the first 17 years of my life. And I would have to admit that probably Tennessee Williams had something to do with my being Robert Indiana. He certainly suggested the idea.
Did you have to move out of Indiana before you could name yourself Indiana?
I could never have done that at home. No, that would have been impossible.
Where were you when you changed your name?
New York.
And what did it mean to be from Indiana to New Yorkers?
Probably not very much at all. An awful lot of New Yorkers have come to New York and become very famous. But the Indiana is simply, it's works, I think, primarily because it's just a very nice sounding name. I mean, to me, when I took it, I thought very much of that. If I had been born in Iowa or Tennessee, for me, that wouldn't have worked. I mean, I wouldn't like to go around with the handle Tennessee, but obviously he doesn't mind, you know.
Did you want to be, like, freed from your past in any way when you changed your name?
I think changing one's name, and I've commented on it in my own work, Terry, particularly with my Picasso painting, it's putting on a mask. It is somehow losing a certain aspect of one's identity and becoming a different person. And that's very much what I wanted to do. I was very depressed at the time. New York was very hard. It was 6 years before I even had my first exhibit in New York, and I really was scraping and scrounging. And choosing the name coincided with the very time when I finally had enough work. I had finally realized my own painting identity, and somehow I thought it was going to be a very special identity, and it should have a special name.
Well, your identity in the early 60s, which I think was when your first New York show was, do I have that right?
Surely. 1960 was the first activity.
Well, you were doing a lot of imagery of, like, road signs, and was there something that made you realize that subject matter like that could be converted, retranslated in some way by you, and that you could use that as subject matter? Was it a realization or a kind of gradual change?
Well, first of all, Terry, just to set the record straight, my first word paintings were not concerned with road signs. My first word paintings, remember that coming from Indiana means one or two things. Indiana is a very literary state. In the 19th century, lots and lots of well-known writers came from Indiana. Only one well-known painter who happens to be William Merritt Chase, who was a great teacher also. But in the 20th century, that's been reversed. Now Kurt Vonnegut is almost besieged by, you know, well-known artists instead. Smith, the sculptor, is from Indiana, and I'm from Indiana, and there's about six of us. Chamberlain, the sculptor, is from Indiana. So that one identifies Indiana with writing more than the visual arts. And when I was in Scotland, due to the situation over there, I was writing more poetry than I was making pictures. And so when I came back to New York, I was writing poetry for a couple of years until I could even begin to afford to buy canvas. It's easier to scribble poetry on paper than it is to paint on canvas. And my first word paintings were really literary paintings. In other words, I took passages from Melville. I took passages from Longfellow. The sign business came later, and it came when I realized that what I didn't want to be was a literary painter, that didn't appeal to me. So I stopped doing the literary paintings, turning then to the signs because, first of all, I like their terseness, their brevity, and they simply worked better with the direction that my work was going to go. My literary paintings would begin to fill whole palaces. I mean, one could go on taking passages from literature ad infinitum. It's an endless source. With signs, say like you mentioned the Eat Die, you don't really go on too much farther from there. When you've said that, you've sort of wrapped it up in a very small package.
So what wasn't satisfying about the literary painting work?
That sort of non-ending, forever aspect. I'm very fond of literature, and there would be so many things that I would want to do. I could never begin to really encompass the whole subject with the social commentary, and in a sense my road sign paintings and so forth has a great deal to do with social commentary, not literature, so that it's more manageable, something that I could possibly handle within one lifetime.
In the 60s, many of the art critics were grouping you with the pop artists. Were you comfortable in that grouping? Did you feel like a pop artist?
That was simply a time situation. For instance, Andy Warhol and I had our first one-man shows together in the same gallery the very same year, so that it sort of all exploded, and I happened to be there at the time. If I am a pop artist, of the six of us, I think is generally considered, and I would consider, that I am the least of the pop artists from the pop standpoint. My work is really very much more involved with something else that they were not involved with. And this stems from my influence and my involvement with an artist like Ellsworth Kelly. In other words, the very nature, my hard edge, the color that I used came from my friend Ellsworth, not from the pop artists. Now, the pop artists did use, all of them used words in their paintings, but except for Lichtenstein and his comic strips, you could hardly call them literary. I mean, it's pow and wow and so forth is, you know, something else.
I think some people might react to some of your paintings, particularly the road signs, as saying, well, that's some of the most vulgar, mundane information that we have in the culture. Shouldn't the artist be doing something that has higher aspirations, that is more beautiful?
Well, you mentioned yourself the one which I can talk probably more about than any other painting, and it is most like the road sign. It is the USA 666, which is in the shape of the danger signal of a railroad crossing. Well, you see, railroad crossings, and I've written about this, Terry, in Indiana, a railroad crossing, you know, hundreds and hundreds of people have died at railroad crossings because the school bus didn't stop, or the young lovers went roaring through, or the daredevil kids just, you know, tried to beat the train. So a railroad crossing is fraught with all kinds of tragedy and kind of melodrama. It's kind of John Dillinger material and remember that I spent my first grade in John Dillinger's hometown. There was all kinds of tenseness and excitement in the air. So I took the danger. The danger sign. I took also the colors. The yellow and black are the colors of all beware danger signs. And on that, there is another painting, by the way, which is red, blue, and green, which are the love colors. And the love colors are the love colors because they were the color of my father's gasoline company that he worked for. Phillips 66 was red and green in the 30s against the blue of a Hoosier sky. The one that you know, the yellow and black one, is a variation on my father's dream. It is the sixth dream because my father was born in June, which is the sixth month, to a family of six members. He worked for Phillips 66. When he left my mother and went west with his new wife, he went via Highway 66, along the roads in the Midwest, passing all those signs on the farmers' fences, and I think I've written as profuse as black-eyed Susan's, the little yellow and black signs that say, use 666, which was a patent medicine for, and still sold in drugstores, for the common cold. But, of course, 666 is also the sign of the devil from a biblical implication, you see. So that vulgar road sign is charged and loaded with all kinds of, lots of other things. My personal history, the history of other people that lived and now are dead, and it's many things beside a road sign, you see. I certainly don't think of it as being vulgar. I mean,
Should we all know that when we go to a museum? Should we
It's helpful.
Have access to that information?
It's helpful, and I'm very fond. Catherine Koo at the Art Institute in Chicago was one of the first curators to make these labels that would go by the side of the painting to explain it. A lot of older, more conservative, shall we say, Philadelphia-type museum curators wouldn't approve of that sort of thing. But I think, a museum is an educational thing, and if a painting is enhanced and a person's experience is enlarged, yes, it should be right there. And if you don't care to read it, you don't have to. You can walk on. But for those who want to know more about something, and with my paintings, as we've gone through with the 666, how could anybody possibly know that that means all those things to me? You see, it's either eat, die, itself, which is some people consider perhaps my very best, the quintessential Indiana, is eat was the last word that my mother said to me before she died, you see. So, and the air hug is a criticism of Midwestern, the puritanical code. I mean, in my family, one could never even say the word love. It had to be just give me a hug, and that's all I ever heard, you see.
Some people say that any work of art needs to stand on its own and speak for itself, and if it needs the placards explaining history, then
I think Terry, if you took the Sistine ceiling, it's awfully nice to know what that cast of characters is. I mean, that's a pretty complicated story up there. I think it's handy to have the Bible around.
How did you first develop the idea for your first in the Love series?
Well, it's a little murky in my own mind, Terry, but what did happen was that the Museum of Modern Art asked me, the ladies, the friends of the museum, asked me if I would design a Christmas card, one Christmas for them, and obviously they had set up a tradition of each year asking an artist, or maybe more, to do a Christmas card. And that is when I had done a love painting, but that it was upon that request that it dawned on me what a proper sentiment it would be for a Christmas card. So I did three small paintings so that they might have the privilege of choosing which one they preferred. And one of those was the red, blue, and green version. It became a Christmas card of the Museum of Modern Art, the most popular Christmas card that they ever published, just as the love stamp became the most popular stamp ever printed. And that's has something to do with its generation. Of course, the background of it is that I was raised as a child as a Christian Scientist, and it is the inscription, God is Love, which I once reversed and made, Love is God. That sort of set me on the mental track to to where I got. It is a formal device. It is the most economical, the most dynamic way to present a four-letter word on a square canvas. And, of course, the O is tilted. It's not an invention of mine. It's an old typographic device. But it simply gave it a little more dynamic thrust. And that's how it came about.
Your sculpture, Love, is in Center City, Philadelphia. What were your formal concerns in taking that surface, that two-dimensional Love, and making it a three-dimensional sculpture?
Well, know that my first work in New York, the first meaningful work, was sculpture. I was really lost as far as painting went. I'd had just an ordinary academic training at the Art Institute in Chicago. When I got to New York, I was thrashing around. Abstract expressionism was the dominant thing. And I did a few drip paintings, and it became quite clear I was not an abstract expressionist. That was not my cup of coffee at all. So it was these meeting certain people like Ellsworth Kelly who definitely influenced me. I had used up my GI Bill and a fellowship that I won from the Art Institute in Chicago. I returned to New York absolutely broke. I had $10, and I had to borrow passage from the American Embassy in London to get back to the United States. I arrived, I knew absolutely nobody in New York except for one friend who had been a model at the Art Institute. And I looked him up, he's the only person I knew to contact. He got me a $7 a week room in Hell's Kitchen in New York, and got me a part-time job so that I was able to immediately start functioning. But it took me 6 years until I got myself together, the act or whatever. I didn't have money for canvas, particularly in those days. People were painting very large and using an awful lot of paint. I would go out at night and steal these beams from the demolition sites, drag them up my five flights to my studio, giving myself a slip disc in the process. And on those beams, they were very narrow. Beautifully, they were hand-carved by the Scandinavian carpenters who had built those channelries and sail lofts in the beginning of the 19th century. I simply took them. They're found objects. Everything was objet trouvé. I simply took them, lightly transforming them. I would add rusted wheels and rusted iron and paint some very simple white geometric shapes with gesso. Then, after accumulating these and having them around for a while, that just somehow wasn't enough. That's when the words started appearing and the color. And because these beams are only about, 8 or 10 inches across, they had to be brief words. Now, those words were not traffic sign words. They were rather more literary, like orb and things of that nature. I did an Ahab because of my involvement with Moby Dick. I don't know whether you know, but on the very first, I think the third paragraph of Moby Dick, the actual street that I lived in New York, which was a very unusual, original Dutch street called Quinty's Slip, and there it is in Moby Dick. Well, that's the sort of thing that would set me off and get me started in that case, a whole series of paintings and sculpture. So that by doing this early sculpture, I had I didn't feel that I was a sculptor exactly, but after so many flat two-dimensional canvases, I really had a real yearning to get back to just the feel of the third dimension. And so it was a delight to turn the Love into a nice, thick thing that, one could really embrace.
What were the differences to you between seeing your sculpture and seeing the paintings of Love?
To me?
Mm-hmm.
Well, there's an enormous difference, Terry, and that is because the sculptures, particularly like the one that's here in JFK Plaza, is not made in my studio. This, they're much bigger loves. I'm very sorry that the Love here is that particular scale. Given the site and so forth, it should be an absolutely enormous Love that people could climb up in and see the skyline from and so forth. But right now, we'll have to stay with a clothespin, let's put it that way. It is. I'm a classmate of Klaus Oldenburg's. We went to school together, by the way. But Klaus's clothespin and Louise Nevelson's metal sculpture and my loves and my art, and these things are fabricated in a real factory. And this is just a few miles away from Yale University. It's a town called North Haven, just outside New Haven. And it is a man whose father was in the steel business, but obviously he was of a certain rebellious turn. He didn't become an artist himself. I think he tried, but it didn't work. But he has become the fabricator of all of a great deal of the large scale outdoor kind of sculpture that's being done in America. So that I, of course, go there, I become involved to a rather minimal extent, more like proofing, just seeing that everything is coming along, rather than actually getting my hands into it. And like Calder, for instance, he really did cut those forms out and do a, you know, very much of his work by himself. He too, though, used fabricators. When it gets to something that's a few tons, you just don't go wrestling around in it. So the sculpture is removed from me. I kind of, it's like an unveiling. I go up to Lippincott's one day and I walk in the door and, ah, there it is, you see. And it's a little more magical than doing a painting where I live with it and I smell the fumes and I, you know, it's all in my hands and it's a different feeling.
Is it magical or is it alienating to have this thing be done but you
magical.
Weren't working on
no,
it every
magical.
Day? Yeah.
No, it's so, because the craftsmen at Lippincott, the workers are very dedicated. They do a beautiful, beautiful job. It's like my silkscreen prints. I wish that my paintings could be as perfect as my silkscreen prints. If it hadn't been for someone like Andy Warhol, although he suggested it with his paintings, I wish that I could do my paintings by silkscreen, because they would be just the way I really want. You know, in my paintings, you really can see a brushstroke here and there. I don't use masking. My paintings are done by hand, so they're just not as perfect as I would like for them to be. With Lippincott's, it's by the great their craftsmanship and their skill, they're able to do things as I wouldn't be able to do. And it's very nice. It's like snapping your fingers and presto, there it is. You see. After months of artwork.
Robert Indiana is my guest, whose love sculpture is in Philadelphia in the JFK Plaza. You said before that a lot of your work you see as social commentary. Do you see the love sculpture in that context, and do you see it as being an optimistic piece?
The love sculpture is in that context, Terry, only, as I mentioned, air as being the only way that I could profess my interest in the subject. By the time, let's say, you know, being on the radio station, you know how many songs in this dippy country are all about love. I mean, it's an endless. If I had been in my right mind, I would have, you know, I'm sure lots of people would express the same sentiment. You know, I should have steered clear of the subject altogether. I mean, it's completely exhausted and iron, but it isn't. It just keeps going on and on and on and so forth. Well, it is my way of making a certain kind of veiled comment from left field. I mean, there is something wrong with America. I mean, there's no question about that. I mean, you know, and this preoccupation with love, there's something very, very strange about it. And so that is a comment. Now, my love is a very restrained, you know, it is my most classic work. It is my most abstract work. It is my coolest work, but even so, we're dealing with a hot subject.
What happens when your intentions get subverted a little bit by the viewers who see it as being an optimistic statement about, you know, all we really need is love, that kind of thing? And
I think John Lennon much good.
You know, like the smile buttons and how eternally optimistic and have a good day they're supposed to be.
I've steered clear of that. Mm-hmm.
Well, it's possible for people to see the love sculpture as being similar to that, you know, in its statement, you know, love, it's nice.
Mm-hmm. But given, and I've always stressed this, Terry, the sources for my love are really spiritual. Not only my simple little childhood exercises in, you know, going to Sunday school in a Christian Science church, but in those dark days in New York when I had no money, I did learn how to type when I was in the Army. I applied for a part-time typing job. And just by an incredible, I feel life is ruled by fate and chance. I'm always very impressed with, and particularly with all the coincidences attendant to that feeling. Of all, you know, I could have been working for Exxon or Bell Telephone or something. My first assignment as a part-time typist was to Bishop Pike at the Cathedral of St. John the Divine. Now, the juicy extra coincidence is now I live on the island in Maine where the monumental, the biggest columns ever attempted carved. They tried to carve them from a single block. They had to finally cut them in half. Those columns come from the island where my studio is now. Well, Pike was the dean of the cathedral. He had just been appointed Bishop of California. All of the Southern Episcopalians were just up in arms. They were incensed by that appointment. Here was a man who'd been a Roman Catholic. Here was a man who'd been divorced. Here was a man who'd been a New York, stockbroker or something dealing with the Wall Street world, that he should become a bishop of the church. So in came this flood of nasty letters, really crack, you know, just terrible, terrible letters. But it was Pike's philosophy. It was his idea that every letter should be answered. I was the typist who typed and answered all those crackpot letters, you see. And, of course, he'd make a very nice comment and turn the other cheek, let's put it that way. Well, we all know what happened to Bishop Pike, and it's one of the reasons that my Hebrew love is in Jerusalem now. My Hebrew love is an homage to the man who directed me very much onto the subject of love. Pike wrote a book about love, particularly about the differences between the carnal and the spiritual and the erotic. And it was the spiritual that I was thinking about when I did my first love, particularly the sculpture, which is aluminum. I mean, it's as remote and as cool and as perfect as a certain kind of conception of heaven itself. And it's just ironic that people should take it otherwise.
You told us before that for some of your works in museum, you like the idea of having a little card next to the painting that tells something
about
it.
Well, this is too complicated. This is too complicated. So that card would be too involved. That's a little book, you see.
Robert Indiana is my guest, and his love sculpture is in Center City. You're now working on numbers. And it's interesting, like letters and numbers are two things that only exist in the abstract world of people. Like they exist, we see them all the time, we use them, we know what they mean, but they don't really exist in the real world, you know? You know
what I mean? They do.
Uh-huh. Now they do.
Well, and they always have. I mean, the world is covered with, those Roman triumphal arches were like one of my sculptures. They were simply covered with words. And when one thinks of the Muslim temples where the figurative is looked at, not very favorably, those beautiful, beautiful temples in Isfahan and so forth, those are all words and beautifully rendered and gorgeous colors, just like my red, blue, and green.
What do you like about numbers?
Numbers are something very personal. As most things in my work are. In Indiana, I said that I spent the first 17 years of my life there. Because of my mother, whose name was Carmen, and it was prophetic, I suppose, my grandfather giving her that name, she really became rather gypsy-like. She couldn't stand to live in one house for more than a year at a time. So by the time I was 17 years old, I had lived in 21 different houses. Well, I'm a collector, I'm a keeper. I couldn't give those. She just turned around and went off into the next sunset with the new house. She was sure that each house was going to be better than the last. But in my mind, in my life, I kept all my houses. And all those houses had a number, you see. So I would go back I begged to go back and see house number one, and I'd also want to see house number six, you see, and I had them all. And I've gone back and made a photographic record of almost some of them have disappeared, but at least I have the site. That's where my preoccupation with numbers started. I was never very good at math, except for geometry. I love geometry, and I did use my numbers in relation to polygons and things like that. It is not, from a mathematical standpoint, that almost a statistical standpoint, that I'm intrigued with numbers and how they relate personally to one's life. My 10 numbers, for instance, are related in color to the 10 stages of man's life as depicted in that old 18th, 19th century print, which is in the form of a pyramid, tracing man from the cradle to the grave, up to his peak, and then down. It's colors, really.
It's interesting to me how personally involved you feel with numbers, since a lot of people feel that numbers are, you know, kind of cold and alienating, except for people who are into a more like mystical relationship or numerological relationship with
I'm
numbers.
Interested in that aspect.
Are you? Mm-hmm. Have you studied that?
I've studied it, but I draw a line. I don't want to become one of those people.
Yeah, where do you draw the line? How can you tell if you're becoming one of those people or if you just have an interesting preoccupation with it?
Probably when people start avoiding you, when they cross to the other side of the street when you go along, then you know you've gone too far. You think.
You've referred a few times to the influence of Ellsworth Kelly on your work. When you first saw his use of color, what was it that
it was like opening a whole new book. I'd had a theory of color theory course at the Art Institute. But at that time, I was into the scene, the regionalists. I was a young kid from Indiana, and people like Thomas Hart Benton and Reginald Marsh and Edward Hopper meant much more to me than any, like Ellsworth, remember, was in Europe for 6 years. And that painting of that kind of refinement and that persuasion seemed very European and very removed from the American experience. I have styled myself, it's been a very conscious effort, I really wanted to be an American artist. So that in using Kelly's color and funneling it back through forms like, as you say, road signs and so forth, I felt that I had Americanized something that otherwise to me seems very European and an experience apart. Now, of course, with this growing sophistication of Americans and our involvement, I don't know, it's probably one can't make those kind of demarcations anymore, but it seemed possible to me at the time. It might have been my own naivete.
You've referred to the problems that America has as a culture and a country, yet you've been interested in being an American.
I'm only interested
in
expanding. I think I am sold on America to the extent that I think our potential is probably endless and unlimited. But I'm embarrassed by how limited it has been. And visually, I mean, we're practically in the same ballpark as England. I mean, we've produced better playwrights and make better movies than we do art. And so, I mean, we've come. That's our origin. I mean, that's the we still have that English culture and so forth. And I would like to see it otherwise. But I wouldn't like to see it via the school of the French. And of course, Ellsworth Kelly and his friend Jack Youngerman were both greatly influenced by the school of Paris when they lived in Paris, and I never got to Paris. It was a dream. I don't think I really ever entertained it, but it certainly didn't happen. And I've never gone back to Europe. I spent only that 1 year of my fellowship there, and never returned. You see.
You collect things, you said, and like to keep things. What kind of objects appeal to you? What kind of objects will you drag home with you to keep in your life?
It isn't so much that I have an acquisitive, that I go out and I'm not a collector in that sense, but things happen to me. For instance, all of my 10 cats that I have, they all came to me. I didn't go out to a pet shop and acquire them or capture them in the wild or something like that. They simply knocked at my door and said they wanted a home. So, and it just with things in my life, like I have all my childhood work. It was never, ever thrown away. My mother didn't keep it. My father didn't keep it. I kept it. I am my own curator. My show that I'm having this summer at the Farnsworth Museum in Maine, it's my own collection. Now, I'd love for it to have been, you know, inclusive. I'd like to go right back to year one and go right straight through. Well, you know, that's a little bit too far out for most museums, and I think it'd be a marvelous show. And, for instance, with someone like Picasso, yes, people really did go right back to his beginnings, and it's all very fascinating. With most artists, I guess there's just not that much curiosity to know how long and the complete process of the making of an artist. You know? But I'm intrigued by it, and all those objects, my little ceramic Mickey Mouses and so forth that I had as a child, my toys. There's certain things one has to give up. I mean, you know, like my high chair, sort of. Disappeared a long time ago, but those which are not too difficult to keep.
Do you have your early finger paintings?
I never did finger painting. I came from Indiana, and there was never anything as progressive or as wild and woolly as that.
Oh, was it wild and woolly? Really?
Oh, yes, I've taught children, surely, and I know what a trap finger painting is. I mean, you've just got endless genius and great talent there. I mean, young kids are. Absolutely marvelous. I don't know what happens, particularly in our system. Something gets ground out of people very early on. But no, I never had that. And that might account for why I didn't have a chance as an abstract expressionist. I mean, a kid who gets finger painting at the age of 8, he might be a Jackson Pollock very easily. Yeah.
Well, do you think there were ever any art students who were expected to paint like you when they were going to art school?
You mean now? In what extent? To what?
Well, it seems that you know, in art schools, if the faculty is within a certain age category, a lot of students are expected to paint within that category. Or when you were coming of age, you were kind of expected to be an abstract expressionist, but you found you couldn't do it.
No, that didn't happen to me because I wasn't. I fell out of that context. I was someplace else. Now I thought. Perhaps your question might be leading to something else. One of the most important things that did happen to me in relation to that, Terry, is that my first grade school teacher in Mooresville, which was John Dillinger's hometown, and John Dillinger had just been killed in Chicago. I was there when, you know, they brought his body back, and it was just a storm of, you know, intrigue and gossip, and because Ma and Pa Dillinger, when they pulled the sheet back, they both in one breath said, "That ain't our son." I mean, you know. So there was just mystery and drama right from the very beginning. But I did little crayon drawings, and I would bring them from home to my first grade school teacher. This was just a very simple country girl. It was her, I didn't know it, it was her very first year of teaching, but she encouraged me, and she, you know, just provided that aspect of love which like watering the seeds. At the end of that first year, she asked me if she could keep some of my work. She said, "Bobby, I think one day you're going to be a famous painter, and it would be so nice to have these things in my trunk, you see." Well, 40 years later, I go back and visit her. She had married, she'd changed her name, and it really took me quite a while to relocate her. But I went to have coffee in her little house in this same town. And in the middle of coffee, she jumps up and goes into the bedroom and brings out my two drawings that she had asked for, you see. Well, that's very special. And who knows how many people there would be doing things if they had that kind of, you know, encouragement and incentive.
Have you ever taught?
Just children for a brief time when I was trying to meet expenses in New York. Found it absolutely exhausting and draining. One has to give too much. And so I've never wanted to be a teacher. It is a thing unto itself. I mean,
so it sounds like your house must be really filled with your personal history.
Crammed to the rafters. In New York, I had a 5-story building. I had 9 different studios filled. When I left New York and moved to Maine, it was 2 vans, 12. 12 trips, and 4 years later, I'm still unpacking. Everything is not unwrapped yet, you see.
I should say, I'm really glad I didn't have to help you move when you were doing that. Do you keep other people's art around? Do you collect other people's art?
Just a few. For instance, I have a painting by Ellsworth Kelly. I have something by Jack Youngerman. And on certain occasions, I have exchanged with artists. I've only gone out and actually bought, like, just two or three things. Usually they've been swaps, which was very typical. I doubt if it's being done now with people bringing the prices that they're bringing now. But in those days, it was very simple for artists to trade each other.
Do you go to museums much?
Even in New York, at the end of those 24 years in New York, Terry, I had begun to shall we say, stop. The scene in New York simply is too heavy. There's too much. One would sort of go blind looking at it all. It's, you know, what is it, 500 galleries, and they change shows, more than once every month. I mean, it is just complete saturation. So one has to skim the top, one takes the cream. And yes, if something good happened, I would go. But for me, the magic wore off in New York. The people who were terribly important for me, like someone like Alfred Barr, who bought my very first painting in New York. Alfred is gone now. And the people who now run and control the scene in New York are no longer as interesting or fascinating.
You've lived and worked in three places that are visually incredibly different from one another, Indiana, New York, and now Maine. Do you find that your interest in shape or color change at all depending on the place that you're working in?
I am not sure about that. No, there's something on my mind now, Terry, and that is that when that move to Maine took place, although I had been on the island since 1969, my movers, who were local fishermen, had to take an extra building because I couldn't accommodate all those things. It turned out that extra building was on the very property where Marsden Hartley had lived when he was on Vinyl Haven in 1938. Hartley never meant very much to me, but after his recent big retrospective in New York, I discovered that those early paintings of his, which are called German military paintings, are really portraits very much in the same manner that I've been doing portraits and self-portraits in the last 10 years, using words, using numbers that relate to a person's life, never any literal representation of the person. And so now I'm very interested in Hartley. He is Maine's most famous native artist, so I want my first work in Maine, my first serious paintings, to be an homage to Hartley as I made my homage to Pennsylvania's Demuth, several years ago. And the coincidence is compounded. Our lives have very similar parallel patterns to them, and I'm intrigued by that.
Well, I want to thank you very much for telling us about your work and about part of your life, and I want to congratulate you again on the award you'll be receiving tomorrow, which is the Award of Excellence from the Friends of the Moore College of Art. Robert Indiana, it's really been a great pleasure to meet and to speak with you. Thank you for being with us. Robert Indiana is a sculptor and painter. His love sculpture is in Philadelphia in the JFK Plaza. He's now living and working in Maine, and the project he's working on now is a series of 8-foot-high numbers, which he described for us a little earlier. Well, that about does it for this afternoon's Fresh Air. Monday afternoon on Fresh Air at 4 o'clock, we'll continue the Marianne McPartland Piano Jazz Series, and her guest at that time will be pianist Ray Bryant. That's at 4 o'clock. Judy Stein will review museum and gallery shows at 3:40. And at 2 o'clock, we'll be talking with a professor from the Annenberg School of Communication at the University of Pennsylvania about computer literacy. What does it mean to be literate in the computer age? That will be at 2 o'clock, and I hope you can join us then. Contributing to this afternoon's Fresh Air has been Bill Van Wert. Dan Laughlin was the technical director. The production assistant is Maeve Magora, and Danny Miller is the associate producer. My name's Terry Gross, and I want to thank you for listening. Have a good weekend. This is WUHY-FM in Philadelphia. Stay tuned now for All Things Considered.
Support for this program comes from the NPR News and Information Fund. Contributors include the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, for international news coverage, the German Marshall Fund of the United States, Hewlett-Packard, worldwide manufacturer of computers and instrumentation for industry and science, and for coverage of science, the National Science Foundation. This program is a production of National Public Radio, which is solely responsible for its content.
Good evening. From National Public Radio in Washington, I'm Sanford Unger.
And I'm Leslie Breeding, with All Things Considered.